The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our conversations that we have on the issue of homelessness and what to do about it. One of the issues that we try to focus on here on the Mark Steiner Show. Natalia Tola has been one of the leading advocates around the issues of homelessness and fighting homelessness out of Los Angeles. She has her own tale to tell about how she came to that sojourn, which we'll get to in the course of this conversation. In 1980, she founded Para Los Niños, for the children, an agency in L.A. Skid Row, which we'll talk a bit about, and many other organizations. And Beyond the Shelter is one that we will begin our conversation about. And Tanya, this is it's interesting to me that in this 22-23 year sojourn you've had as being an activist around the issue of homelessness, that your perspective and the one that you gave to Congress just recently is one that's a bit different, because you take it from the perspective that housing is not something that, as many nonprofit groups do in this country, is something people who are homeless have to show they can earn and can take care of. But you take it from the perspective of this is where we start out as a right. This is where the conversation should begin.
Yes, housing is, in fact, one of the basic human rights. And, of course, we need to begin with that.
But that is antithetical to the way a lot of people think in the world of social services, that people are homeless because they're addicted, they're homeless because they can't maintain a home for whatever reason, and that they go to shelters and then they have to kind of prove themselves to be able to get an apartment.
Yeah, well, you sometimes wonder how we got here, because we really are in our third decade of homelessness in America, and people in the field and people who see homeless people truly want to help. But sometimes in our efforts to help, we have, in fact, hindered. And inadvertently, we have, through our efforts to help in the right way, we think, we thought, now we know we were wrong, during the first two decades of homelessness, created what is, in fact, a subclass in America today, a subclass called the homeless. And our programs and our systems have almost helped to perpetuate that existence of homelessness, when in fact it's actually not rocket science. You end homelessness by getting people back into housing, and that's where they used to be before we had a housing crisis.
talk about it. Get us to the place where we are now. I mean, it is something that seemed to really have grabbed American consciousness and became a fact of life in America, this issue of mass homelessness, that actually began in the 80s. I mean, and what happened then, do you think?
Well, first of all, homelessness is a housing issue. When rents are unaffordable, people lose their housing. The first to fall out of housing and not have someone back them up with a safety net often are, first of all, certainly the very poor, but people who maybe forgot to pay rent because they have an addiction or a domestic violence issue caused a woman to flee. There are secondary factors, because then maybe she can't get back into housing. People lose their jobs. Eventually, they get evicted. There are a multitude of reasons why people lose their housing, but then the problem is they can't get back into housing. So the effort of the federal government to provide new targeted funding for homeless programs had to very carefully identify who, in fact, was homeless and make sure that only people who were homeless got those services. And that's sort of, if you think about it, how we began to label people as homeless or not homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that there are more people with drug addictions and domestic violence and low incomes, and maybe unstable living patterns, who could be your neighbor next door. There are more people in housing with problems than homeless. It's just the people who lose their housing and have a trouble getting back in and lose it first when there's a housing or financial crisis are the most vulnerable people among us. And by virtue of that description, they're going to be people with mental illness who aren't getting proper health care, people with disabilities who aren't getting proper health care, single mothers who don't have a family with enough income to take them into their large home like other working class or other families who have a housing crisis can do. And so it's the poorest among us who end up becoming homeless and not getting out of homelessness and creating a growing subclass in America.
And is this, do you think, growing into becoming a permanent subclass in America?
Well, we've done a lot of stuff that could, in fact, make that true, that it becomes a permanent subclass in America. Even today, with all the new programs and efforts, there's still a subclass of the subclass.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, let's talk about welfare reform and its impact on homelessness. You know, if the income on welfare you have when you're unemployed and have children to care for ends at 5 years, except for children born after a certain date, and so your income goes from 500 to 300, how are you ever going to get back into housing without a rent subsidy? So there are things we know to do. Section 8 subsidies can help someone like that get back into housing. Once in housing, many people get jobs. While they're homeless, they don't. And maybe it's better for a mother with young children to work part-time and help raise them, make sure they get good grades in school, and then go back to work like many other people do. So, I mean, there are a lot of different ways you have to look at what people's lives really are like. Single unemployed people who might have mental illness or who maybe are just dysfunctional because they've been in and out on the streets for a few months, often given housing, just a very small bit of housing, stable housing of their own, an apartment, a microwave to cook in. After a few weeks of getting their head on straight and getting some rest, might in fact be very capable of going out and increasing their income and eventually, again, become a participating member of society. We have just made sure that if we can, while people are homeless, that they're in programs. And the problem with that is the programs are recycling these people in and out the door. The effort we should be making is to make housing that we have more affordable, and we should be creating new housing at the same time.
Given the world we live in now, where we are, the society is so, society, no, when politicians in Capitol Hill and state governments are so concerned with budget deficits, with the with spend, and we're spending too much money on social services, too much worrying, can spend too much money on Social Security and on Medicare and Medicaid, and those are the places that people are looking to cut. And so, on the one hand, you've opened a door to kind of try to help people think about homelessness in a different way in terms of how we have to attack it. At the same time, you're being confronted by a period of time we live in when this seems to be the first things that are going to go.
Well, it's a crazy world right now, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is.
Did you want me to answer that?
Yes, I'm curious about how, I'm just, before we talk about some more specifics and about what you've done and where we need to go, I mean, politically, we're at a very strange point when homelessness, from all accounts, is rising and middle-class homelessness is on the rise, besides the chronic homelessness of the poor working class and poor people and people who are addicted and people who are mentally ill and people who have been shoved into homelessness over the last 30 years. But now we see a new rise in homelessness and people not being able to get food stamps, I think, as you talked about in your congressional testimony. And so what I'm saying is we're in a very difficult political juncture for all this right now.
Yes, we are. And we have, you know, a recession going on. People who are currently homeless have not been able to get out of homelessness, new people are becoming homeless, particularly families with children, which is a tragedy that can have lifelong impact on the children, and our government programs and our local programs are being cut, again, often because of the economy. We also have a war going on that's draining us. So the question is, I mean, this is not a new story in America.
No.
The question is, are we going to be smart about this and take existing funding that we now have and use it rightly? What should we be doing with the pool of money that we have? There are funding streams right now going into communities, into deep, dark, black holes, and you never see any impact on the ground. The Obama administration has understands this and has made some efforts with the stimulus funding to require that recipients in different sectors, employment, housing, labor, talk to each other and connect to each other and make sure that the resources are used appropriately to help make change in people's lives and in communities. So that's what we should be focusing on with all of our currently existing money, instead of trying to using the excuse you can't do something because there is no money.
We're talking with Tanya Tull at the moment. Tanya Tull has been a significant activist and thinker and in the issue of homelessness. She's the founder of Para Los Niños in L.A., the Los Angeles Family Housing Coalition Beyond Shelter, where she is CEO and Beyond CEO of Beyond Shelter, and has become a prominent international voice and is now also a senior fellow at Ashoka that she was appointed to in 2009. And so, going back to kind of the premise of how we get to this, the place where we shift policy and understanding to put people who are homeless into places where they can live. I saw a study earlier this morning from an article in USA Today, I think earlier this year or last year, that showed how that it is actually more expensive to fund homeless shelters than it is to begin to figure out how to subsidize some housing.
That is very, very true. And the cost of serving homeless people in America today, in shelters, in transitional housing, even the development of housing for the homeless, which I abhor, I think that is helping to perpetuate a subclass called the homeless. You know, it's basically what our efforts should be targeting instead is making existing housing more affordable and creating affordable housing at the same time in communities for everybody to live in, and also supporting the concept of housing choice. Just because you're homeless doesn't mean you should be forced to live in a certain building with a bunch of other people who were homeless. So, you know, we're touching on a bunch of red flags of concern that I have regarding where policy and practice are actually even going as we make changes away from the shelter system. Are we going to continue also to maintain people in a segregated system of housing and services as we try to move them out of shelters?
Now in L.A., you have put thousands of people, I read, I think the last statistic, close to 5,000 people into rental units, that people who have been referred to Beyond Shelter. You just said two things. You said, A, you abhor housing for the homeless, and that we talked about how the shelter system is more expensive than putting people in rental units. So I'm curious about how you would address this to the leaders of political leaders locally in this country who manage the homeless. All have these kind of assistance to the mayor for homelessness and who manage this program. How would you begin to talk to them about how to shift that?
Well, first of all, you do have to have a major mind shift. My mind shift occurred in the late 80s after I developed two family shelters in L.A. and discovered that families were cycling between shelter to shelter and new shelters that other people were developing and pretty soon specialized transitional housing, and at the end of 1, 2, 3 years, these families with children were still homeless. Because once you become homeless, it's almost impossible to get back into housing. You have an eviction on your record. You don't have the move-in funds. Rents are unaffordable. You need subsidies. If you're unemployed, you're not going to rent a unit. So what I did is I dropped all my work, and I created Beyond Shelter with the main focus being how to get homeless people back into housing. And I was told I couldn't do it because there was no affordable housing. Well, in my mind, our challenge in ending homelessness is to focus on figuring out how to overcome that challenge. And there are many different ways you do that. I found that, in fact, there were rental units out there in the community that were affordable, but homeless families needed somebody to find them, talk to the landlord, explain, you know, that the eviction was because the woman's husband was dealing drugs and went to prison and she's not, or whatever the story might be, or that he was released from a state hospital and stopped taking his meds, and that's why he's been evicted, the single man who's been on the streets. But we're now an agency that's going to, once we get him back into housing, he's going to be coming to day treatment programs and taking medication, and the woman whose husband left her and went to prison and got evicted is going to get her children back in school, and she's a nurse, and maybe she can get back to work after she gets housing. And here's move-in funds. And as rents became unaffordable, we began working with the housing authority and managed to get a set-aside for the frail elderly, disabled, and families with children who were homeless. So that the 5,000, it's not 5,000 people, Beyond Shelter has helped 5,000 homeless families with children,
mm-hmm.
maybe, you know, 15,000 children,
mm-hmm.
get back into housing in residential neighborhoods throughout L.A. County with their own lease. We get the families. It's a unique setup in L.A. It's a very big county. 65 different agencies send us homeless families that they're sheltering. You need shelter. You can't have someone floating on the streets while waiting to get housing. So you need the shelter system. But you need someone in the shelter system or working with the shelter system to be focusing on how to get that individual or that family unit back into an apartment or a rental house at a rent they can't afford as quickly as possible. And as quickly as possible could take a few months. But the point is your effort shouldn't be on trying to fix something that people who aren't homeless also have. You know, we're people. We have lives. We make mistakes. We're poor. It's an accident of birth. A lot of stuff is temporary. What you need to be doing is ensuring people are supposed to live in housing, that the barriers to them getting housing is broken down. You also need to be developing affordable housing in communities. That helps prevent homelessness, and it helps people who are homeless get back into housing, but they can also get back into housing that exists right now, given a rent subsidy or a landlord willing to negotiate a lease down because this family that I'm moving in is going to have a caseworker supporting her for 6 months to a year while she is assisted and her children are assisted in overcoming the trauma that they experienced while homeless. Homelessness causes trauma. People who are homeless get under a microscope, and every little blemish looks like, you know, some horrible thing that needs to be fixed before they earn the right to housing. It's not a right that has to be earned. It is a human right.
And you, one of the things you've testified about and written about is that you see the lack of housing, people who are homeless, as trauma.
Well, losing your housing is a trauma. Losing your job is a trauma. Getting a divorce is a trauma. It's a traumatizing situation to be out there with nowhere to sleep.
And so, I mean, because many people would say, I mean, as we go back to the logic of the idea of housing first, which is the position that you've been advocating for, that maybe people would say, no, jobs first, no social services first, no, that we have to stabilize people before we can put them in a home, because that's not gonna stabilize the situation.
This is why it's backwards. The home stabilizes you. when you're in a state of trauma, you can't think straight. You become immobilized. You're thinking in crisis. You're thinking where you're going to be next week. Your children are disrupted from their friends and what they the environment that they know. It totally makes dysfunctional every aspect of life for single people alone, people with children, extended family units experience homelessness today. And so, yes, you need housing first, because what we have learned is that people are more responsive to interventions and offers of support from a stable, permanent housing base. And a lot of the social services that my agency delivers to families after we help them move into housing is assistance in overcoming the trauma they experienced being homeless, including in the programs that they stayed at. But we've developed good partnerships. The 65 agencies that refer homeless families to us are drug treatment programs, domestic violence shelters, halfway houses, just the emergency family shelter programs that exist, including with families in motels for shelter. And so these agencies are providing stabilization. It's crisis intervention and short-term stabilization. But without the next step, moving back into permanent housing as quickly as you can with social services before and after, you'll never get to the point that you're ready and able and know where you are at so that you can go to work or get higher education for training, technical assistance, or for people who are unable to work, the sources of support and the systems around them that give them quality of life. You know, we just completely lost sight of quality of life.
How has the face of homelessness changed in the last several years? My sense of talking to lots of people who work in this area is that it has changed markedly just because of the numbers of new people who are periodically homeless because of America's economic downturn.
Well, that's what we're seeing is a new face of homelessness. We're seeing people who are in the middle and working class falling into homelessness or on the edge of it. And some of the new money that's out there is really targeted to these people, which is good because you want to divert people from the homeless services system. The problem is that we haven't fixed it yet for all those people who fell in before. We've done a lousy job of it.
Well, I guess, clearly we have. I mean, because I've watched this happen here from where we're broadcasting in Baltimore and where you're coming to this evening to speak. And there's this massive mayor's commission that I sit on about homelessness and coming up with a plan to kind of end homelessness in Baltimore by, I think it's 2015. But I think the problem is that, I mean, every city probably has commissions similar to this. And the question is, how do you really begin to change, how do you really begin to force a housing market to open up to people who have been homeless?
Well, it's actually not rocket science. Again, it wasn't that hard 20-some years ago. I wondered myself. So I went to the real estate world and found out that there was something called housing relocation specialists. Like if they're building a new freeway or destroying old downtowns for new development, they have to relocate people. And I hired one. And I said, look, this is kind of unique, but I've been told that I can't do this because there's no affordable housing. And at that point, I was really ready in my career because it was awful to watch people homeless not get out. I was ready to go home and lock the door and pull the bed covers up over my eyes because I felt that there was something awful being a part of this, running the shelters. So this woman said to me, oh, my goodness, she said, there's, first of all, affordable housing out there. But, of course, it was out there, small mom and pops who owned three or four units out there in residential neighborhoods that we didn't know about. and that we had no contact with. And what we've developed and what we've promoted and what people now do in our field is have housing specialists. They're not social workers. You know, the landlord is running a business. He's got a bottom line of money. So he's going to get a screen tenant who's got a backup. Most of the tenants don't have a backup if they get behind in the rent or if someone loses a job. We get calls from landlords about tenants who aren't our clients. But we provide access to tenants if they house a family or an individual that's been homeless. And there are a lot of, in fact, I'm doing a presentation tomorrow at a conference here in Washington, D.C. on landlord incentives, monetary and other kinds of incentives to have them take a chance on somebody who has become homeless. And it's a real activity that is now funded by homeless funding streams to help end homelessness. It works best when you've got also somebody who's dealing with helping people connect to resources in their new community for longer-term support if they need it, or to maintain sobriety, or to get into treatment, or to now try to find a job. And so you need, that's what I'm talking about, the funding streams going into dark black holes. They need to land on the street and work together in an integrated way. And there's one other thing that I'm really focusing on lately, and that's the research. Research on homeless families, for example, has shown and demonstrated very clearly that homeless families and low-income families who aren't homeless are very much the same. They are the same, and they have the same needs. And we already know what to do with low-income families to help them. We just aren't doing it very well. So we don't need a separate, expensive system that keeps people segregated because they've lost their housing. We need to integrate them back into communities as quickly as we can. We know what to do with people who aren't homeless, who aren't family units, too. We do know. We just don't do it very well. So we need to just do all the things we know how to do for people in communities with special needs and create new housing and also subsidize existing housing at the same time, because the truth is rents are unaffordable for a lot of people, not just people who've become homeless. And if none of this is rocket science, I am bewildered, really, why it's not easier for people.
I can hear the bewilderment in your voice and the way you respond to some of the things we've been talking about. And I'm curious about a couple of things. A, how do you incentivize reluctant landlords to want to rent to those who have been homeless? Because there's such a stigma there.
Well, first of all, let me just tell you, we have landlords who call us now when they have an opening, a vacancy. We don't even have to look anymore, because they would rather have an agency help them get the tenant, and if there's a problem, they can call the agency. With other tenants, you know, who look good, get screened in, seem to have good credit, it could be a drug dealer, it could just be a dysfunctional family that screams all the time, who knows, you know. So that's one incentive. Another is rental guarantee programs, assistance with eviction monetarily if you have to do that, or there are some city and state programs, actually city or county programs, that will provide rehabilitation money to a landlord to upgrade a building if X number of units are rented out to people who are homeless or families who are homeless. You know, we have marketing materials. We deal with landlords on an ongoing basis from a business point of view. And then each family that we serve has a case manager for 6 months to a year. Some organizations that have adopted our model around the country might hook them up to support through a housing authority that has caseworkers, and they get support for 5 years. We've just created an approach, and the approach is, if you're homeless, the answer is getting them into housing where people are supposed to be. And whatever it takes to do that is what your activity each day is composed of and where the funding should be targeted. the effort to get people out of homelessness back into housing and then to help them stabilize there and make connections to community. So how communities are doing this is very diverse sometimes, depending on resources and intentions and the target populations, but they are doing it.
Where do you see evidence of this happening, if anywhere, on a major scale? What you're advocating for?
Well, on a major scale, a lot of smaller communities, L.A., it's very difficult. It's, you know, the homeless capital of America. Chicago has transformed to this approach. Hennepin County, Minnesota, Columbus, Ohio, New York has systems in place. They're just like L.A. It's increasing beyond the ability to respond appropriately. But a lot of smaller communities, too. We've been doing workshops and trainings and consulting to organizations in states throughout the country and Canada. So, I mean, it's a movement that has been going on for quite a while. People are confused. They're not sure what it means. I've seen some federal or in government funding that says housing first means they have to be housed in 30 days. Well, 30 days is ridiculous if you've got children. That's only if you already own the housing yourself. So, I mean, you know, it's hard. People need to calm down. Calm down. It's not hard. This is just how do we make housing more affordable and how do we make a plan to get somebody in it?
You see, it's good that you can approach this thing like in a very calm demeanor. That's a good thing.
Thank you. I mean, somebody's got to be sane here.
your own sojourn to this place, I mean, I was interesting. I was reading a bit about you and that you had actually, as a very young woman, gone to Israel, lived in a kibbutz that changed you, but then you began changing even more after you faced what you faced when you came home.
Right.
Share that with the listeners a little bit. I think there's a really interesting kind of piece of your own journey to this place.
Well, I mean, I landed in Los Angeles with an Israeli husband and a small baby and no job. And money we had ran out before, still no job. And we were concerned about literally being able to pay rent and having food to eat. So we did go to a welfare office, and we received welfare for 90 days until somebody said, hey, they're hiring, and that's how I got into the field. I went to work as a social worker with on-the-job training. I, of course, had a college degree at that point, and went to work in South L.A. right after the Watts riot, South Central L.A., and that was quite an interesting experience, and that's, for myself, I had said, if somebody with everything I have had going for myself can suddenly fall down a deep dark hole and, you know, can't find the ladder out, what about people who have not had my opportunity? And I understood then and there it was an accident of birth. Mm-hmm. Somebody was born in, you know, South L.A. or a child was living in Skid Row and somebody living in Beverly Hills or the Upper East Side. So This empathy and this experience has tempered my work ever since and kept me humble, trust me.
I believe that. At the end of your congressional testimony at the Maxine Waters hearing, the stuff you talked about is stuff that I think would be the political battleground to make this happen. And that is really interesting as I was reading what you told them, the idea of expanding Section 8 set aside programs, the idea of authorizing the use of emergency hotel vouchers for master leasing apartments, as you talk about, which would be interesting to talk about for a moment, and everything you're talking about really calls for a change in the way public policy and our political leaders work when they deal with homelessness. And it also, well, let's just stop there for a moment. I mean, it's almost like grabbing folks gently by the lapels and saying, look, there's a way to do this.
Yes. That's sort of what it's like. And in fact, you know, think change happens in incremental steps. It is now happening. This master leasing of apartments, I think, is really, its time is right now to use as shelter because of this current economic crisis and the need to shelter people while we fix their crisis and get the pieces back together. And what that is, and I've been, I use my work in Los Angeles as a laboratory for social change. That's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
With the shelters full, many organizations, and in fact we still use FEMA for funding for hotel vouchers for the emergency crisis of homelessness, many agencies put families in motels. Well, you know, this is not very family friendly, and usually they are, wherever you are in the country, those hotels are often surrounded by prostitution and drug activity and other environmental issues that are not safe for children, families with children particularly. So what we began experimenting with, we found that it was cheaper to rent an apartment in a residential neighborhood for a family with a couple of bedrooms and a kitchen, and even to furnish it and get some insurance on it, and to lease it in our own name and use it as emergency shelter. It was cheaper than a motel night for 30 days. Think about this. 30 days in a hotel at with tax, maybe $60 a night. That's $1,800. I can rent an apartment for $900
mm-hmm.
and furnish it, and even, you know, prorating that all across 1 year, put two or three homeless families at one at a time in there for 2 to 3 months at a time while they stabilize mentally, get some rest, begin to cook and clean in a normal way, normal living patterns once again, while every effort is made to get them back into an apartment or some rental housing. So in this situation, you could do that right where a family used to live, and you could also help them take over that rent so that they don't even move again. So a unit becomes, an apartment becomes their emergency shelter, their transitional housing, and their permanent housing, and the kids have never changed schools. So I know that sounds kind of like crazy, but really it's not. It's sort of the humanitarian, realistic approach to trying to do our best for families rather than make them dislocate and go live in some communal environment that is not the way normal people live.
Tanya Tullis, CEO of Beyond Shelter. We need innovative new discussions on how to deal with homelessness and address it, and this is one of the ways to start. Tanya Tullis, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I hope we have a chance to meet.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.